Canadian Poetry in English Since 1867. This is an article in the Journal of Commonwealth Literature for July 1967. The first poetry written in Canada was colonial, as I suppose it was in any other new country. No doubt the first poetry written in the Greek colony at Syracuse was Greek, and the first in the erstwhile Spanish South American possessions strongly resembled its Spanish models. Thus, the first Canadian poetry imitated that of England in the 19th century, and imitated so badly that it is now virtually unreadable. Oliver Goldsmith's 1794-1861, The Rising Village, is a good example. It describes pioneer hardships with a series of continuous clichés, English clichés, not Canadian. What noble courage must their hearts have fired! How great the ardor which their souls inspired! At the time this sort of thing was written, it just might have proven interesting to the descendants of English-speaking pioneers, though it's likely Goldsmith, Charles Heavysides, Susanna Moody, Charles Sangster, and others of their time hoped for a readership in Britain. Until the era of the Confederation poets, say about 1880 and after, Bliss Carman, Archibald Lampman, Duncan Campbell Scott, Charles G.D. Roberts, Wilfred Campbell, perhaps even Charles Mair, no writer could look at Canada without seeing also the superimposed map of England in his mind's eye. But these poets self-consciously set out to create a body of Canadian poetry, something their predecessors failed to accomplish. Their models and preceptors were still English, Matthew Arnold, Keats, Shelley, Tennyson, Swinburne, but they did possess the small virtue of being able to look directly at the objects and country they were writing about, and nature, with a capital N, comprised 90% of their subject matter. Of the six poets named above, Archibald Lampman's 1861-99 fame seems to survive with least damage, perhaps because he died young, and thus has romantic associations with Keats and Shelley. I believe Lampman was also consumptive. Perhaps by accident, Lampman did write one slight exquisite lyric, Morning on the Levre, in 1888, surely the earliest genuine poem written in Canada. Charles G.D. Roberts, 1866-1943, was also a nature boy, with occasional resounding trumpet blasts of empire. He was knighted in 1935, when titles were permitted in Canada. But Roberts' work retains little of interest today. There had to be historical forerunners, and he was one of them. Bliss Carman, 1861-1929, I better say that again. Bliss Carman, 1861-1929, had the mixed good and bad fortune to have been born with a banjo already strumming in his breast. The strong musical quality of his poems hypnotized some and irritated others. He seems to have been entirely ignorant of iambic pitfalls. But Carman was, along with Roberts, among the first of many talented Canadians to emigrate to the USA, perhaps because of greater poetic opportunities there. At least one supposes that to be the reason for emigration. For a few years, U.S. editors thought he was an American and included him in their anthologies. Carman is somewhat a puzzle to me. His rushing iambic rhythms and pre-Tarzan nature cult give him little claim to real accomplishment. But the intangible, difficult-to-define sadness in some of his work has a mournful attraction, even for a reader in A.D. 1967. Was it a year or lives ago? We took the grasses in our hands and caught the summer flying low over the waving autumn lands, and held it there between our hands. This verse is from Low Tide on Grand Pre, generally regarded as Carman's best poem, and I think with good reason, but most of the time his banjo strummed with sweet monotony. Of Mair and Wilfred Campbell, not much can be said. The former is unreadable, the latter an unfortunate colonial stereotype, nature and empire, and vice versa, for startling variation. Duncan Campbell Scott, 1862-1947, is of another breed entirely. Probably for the first time in Canada, a writer looked at Indian as if they were people. Scott possessed the same ideas of a healing and benevolent nature Carman, Roberts, and Lampman cherished, but also a realistic insight far beyond theirs. His poetry oscillates between romanticism and realism, as if both were part of his own life, which was spent as a civil service official in the Department of Indian Affairs. He was tied to a desk most of the time, but went on occasional wilderness expeditions with friends, notably Archibald Lampman. Scott is the most varied and interesting of the Confederation poets. He lacks the music of Carmen, the very occasional clear vision of Roberts and Lampman. Quotation, except in full, serves him badly. He is an anachronism, an anomaly of his time and place. A splendidly original early poet who repressed his possibly rebellious instincts to become a very successful civil servant. At least four of these six Confederation poets knew each other personally. Roberts, among the least notable as a poet, is given credit for stimulating Lampman, Carmen, and Scott, providing a yeasty, pioneer-come-backwards enthusiasm. It was the first Canadian school or group, and so deserves passing attention. But that's about all. The Confederation group was the first to become a literary entity in this country. It was also the first group to slide into an obscurity that likely awaits its successors. One of these early poets, George Frederick Cameron, 1854-85, seems to have lived and died almost anonymously. No biographical trace remains. Despite the old-fashioned language and form of his poems, Cameron occasionally can convey delayed action, small voltage jolts to the reader. Jolts to the reader. He was in no way typical of his time. Draw the dread curtain and enter in. In o'er the threshold the millions have trod. Lose but the dust of the balance and win. But a moment ago was the secret of God. The time juggling inherent in the phrase a moment ago seems to me curiously modern. In addition to the minor figures of the Confederation poets, there were also the minor minuscule of the era until 1920. Isabella Valency Crawford, Marjorie Pickthall, William Henry Drummond, and others too numerous to be named here. The oddly assorted figures of Wilson MacDonald and Robert Service, the visiting Englishman, might be mentioned. And Tom McInnes, 1867-1951, who managed the following near surrealistic stanza sometime after the 19th century. Last night, in a land of triangles, I lay in a cubicle where a girl in pajamas and bangles slept with her hands in my hair. Zelinka. Modern Canadian poetry began during the 1920s. That decade marked the emergence of E.J. Pratt, a young immigrant, we have so many, from Newfoundland, who helped put himself through the University of Toronto by selling patent medicine. Pratt is the only poet given credit for something close to greatness in Canada, and it is in his long narrative work that he justifies, to some extent, the enthusiasm of his supporters. The following is the end of Brébeuf and his brethren. Where was the source of his strength, the home of his courage that topped the best of their braves, and even outfabled the lore of their legends? In the bunch of his shoulders which had often carried a load, extorting the envy of guides at an Ottawa portage, the heat of the hatchets was finding a path to that source. In the thews of his thighs which had mastered the trails of the neutrals, they would gash and beribbon those muscles. Was it the blood? They would draw it fresh from its fountain. Was it the heart? They dug for it, fought for the scraps in the way of the wolves. But not in these was the valor or stamina lodge, nor in the symbol of Richelieu's robes or the seals of Mazarin's charters, nor in the stir of the lilies upon the imperial folds, nor yet in the words Loyola wrote on a table of lava stone in the cave of Manresa. Not in these the source, but in the sound of invisible trumpets blowing around two slabs of board, right-angled, hammered by Roman nails, and hung on a Jewish hill. Pratt's poetry is a celebration of strength, both in nature and man. A.J. M. Smith says that he has an affinity with Masefield and Roy Campbell's longer work, perhaps. However, as apart from literary sources, Pratt strikes a vigorous blow for realism. but preoccupation with historical and also highly imaginative themes, such as the building of the Canadian Pacific Railway, the sinking of the Titanic, the fight between whale and giant squid in The Cachalot, tends to make his work epic rather than contemporary and human. When the Titanic sank, Pratt says of the iceberg which caused the disaster, silent, composed, ringed by its icy broods, the gray shape with the Paleolithic face was still the master of the longitudes. The decade, 1920-30, was a period of underground literary fecundity in Canada. Poets were beginning to speak frankly about their personal lives and more honestly about nature's less attractive aspects, without the capital N. Silent, composed, ringed by its icy broods, the gray shape with the Paleolithic face. Was still the master of the longitudes. The decade, 1920-30, was a period of underground literary fecundity in Canada. Poets were beginning to speak frankly about their personal lives, and more honestly about nature's less attractive aspects, without the capital N. They were developing an economy of expression and terseness of thought, but still keeping within the traditional European modes. In 1925, two young McGill University students, Frank Scott, born 1899, and Arthur Smith, born 1902, started the McGill Fortnightly Review. The English-sounding name is perhaps inevitable. The friendship and literary association, begun in 1925 and continued to the present day, marked the beginning of the Montreal group of poets. A.J.M. Smith advocates eclecticism and the classical attitude and was influenced by Eliot and Yeats. His theories have had wide circulation in critical articles, but do not seem to have influenced other poets very much. In his own poetry, Smith sometimes strikes a note from his theoretical point of view which involves something contradictory to it. "I would take words," he says, "to hold in a verse as austere as the spirit of prairie and river, lonely, unbuyable, dear, the north is a deed and forever, to hold in a poem." That verse may be eclectic, but it is more than just that. Frank Scott has lived a political, academic, socially involved life, reminiscent of Yeats' Smiling Public Man. His poems run from the personal to sociological and sharply satiric, bon entente. The advantages of living with two cultures strike one at every turn, especially when one finds a notice in an office building: "This elevator will not run on Ascension Day," or reads in the Montreal Star, "Tomorrow being the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, there will be no collection of garbage in the city," or sees on the restaurant menus the bilingual dish: "Deep apple pie, tart aux pommes profondes." Now, correct me on that one. Oh? The undercurrent of revivalism in the 1920s did not end with Smith and Scott in Montreal. W. E. Ross was writing his chiseled imagistic poems in Ontario, Raymond Nister realistic rural poems, and Dorothy Livesey her strongly social poetry, at that time also in Ontario. In 1942, Earl Burney, born 1904, published his first book, David and Other Poems. Burney is a Westerner from Calgary, who later lived in Vancouver. Along with Klein, Pratt, and Irving Layton, he is one of the four most prominent Canadian poets. Burney is difficult to characterize, his work alternating from an occasional personal voice to the highly objective. Over the years, he has hammered out an individual style that owes something to Chaucer or a little to James Joyce, but has absorbed all his influences in such a way that none dominate him. Only his long poem play, Trial of a City, betrays its obvious debt to James Joyce. Burney is, in some ways, the first person plural, a most sensitive billboard. He's much more a public poet than any but Irving Layton. He writes to the Canadian mountains and the social and political mores of his time. In one poem about pre-Columbus sailors, Mapamund in Anglo-Saxon English, is so cleverly constructed that no one has ever identified it as an oblique love poem. Mapamunda. No, not this old whale haul can whelm us. Ship team, gull grace, soft to our glidings. Here is that mere moor which squares our map. See in its north where scribe is marked merman. Shore sneakers who croon to the seafarer's girl next year's glee words. East and west, natters. Flame fang bale twisters, their breath dries up tears, charge in the breast horde, the brave face pictures. Southward, Setigran, that sly beast who sucks in with whirlwind also the wanderer's pledges. That sea is height time, it hems all heart's land trace. Men say the reedless, reaching its bounds, topplin' maelstrom, tread back never. A dread in that mirror, we drift towards map's end. Burney has gone from strength to strength since the publication of David. A barren period after Trial of a City in 1952 ended 10 years later with publication of 3 successive books, and another is scheduled. He's one of the very few poets who has had a fully rounded career, and at the age of 62 seems to be achieving another period of growth. The long poem, The Mammoth Corridors, is both typical of the earlier... Burney and yet signifies the new. No other poet I know of would describe an automobile as the master I own, or the mining town of Sedbury as the place where God invented a special cough. He is the youngest 62-year-old in Canada, and perhaps the most interesting. I hope he lives forever. In the 1930s, poems by Abraham Klein, a Montreal lawyer, began to appear in magazines, though his first book was not published until 1940. Inevitably, Klein is regarded as a poet of the Montreal group, but in theme and content, he scarcely resembles them at all. Although contained by traditional metrics and form, Klein manages to express a many-sided portrait of himself and the French province in which he lived. A strange combination of lyrical, romantic idealist, who never lost his sense of wonder, yet with a realism so cold as to chill the Canadian reader, even today, when he describes Chameleon Hood discussing conscription at a French-Canadian political meeting during the last war. He is tearful, choking tears, but not he would blame the clever English. In their place, he'd do the same, maybe. Where are your sons? The whole street wears one face, shadowed and grim, and in the darkness rises the body odor of race. Political meeting. Or else he congeals a province several times the size of England in one stanza of the rocking chair. It is act and symbol, symbol of the static folk which moves in segments and returns to base. A sunken pendulum, invoke, revoke, loosed yon, leashed hither, motion on no space. Oh, like some Anjou ballad, all refrain, which turns about its longing and seems to move, to make a pleasure out of repeated pain, its music moves, as if always, back to a first love. And then, with a deft change of pace, he describes youngsters being sprayed with a garden hose on a hot summer day in Montreal. Oh, crisscross beneath the spray, those pelting petals and peas, those soft white whisks brushing off heat. Oh, underneath these acrobatic fountains, among the crystal like raindrops, a shower of youngsters dance. Small nippled, self-hugged boys and girls with water sheer going ah and ah. Pastoral of the city streets. Klein's The Rocking Chair, published in 1948, is a major landmark in Canadian poetry. The poems cry out joyously and variously, level shafts of satiric wit in all directions, and change tone unexpectedly to achieve a moving personal eloquence. Klein was the nth atom, taking a green inventory in a world but scarcely uttered in his own poem. But he's been silent now for nearly 20 years. The two decades from 1930 to 1950 are perhaps the most interesting in Canadian poetry. Many new writers appeared, among them Robert Finch, Louis Mackay, Roy Daniels, Malcolm Lowry, an English visitor who stayed, John Glasgow, Ralph Gustafson, Irving Layton, Douglas Lapan, Wilfred Watson, Miriam Waddington, P.K. Page, Margaret Iveson, Louis Dudek, Raymond Soester. Far too many for me to quote from each, as I would like to. Around 1940, the English Patrick Anderson made Montreal one of the stops in his academic world tour. He brought with him Dylan Thomas's non-patented rhythms, which were entirely new in Canada, and thus seemed original and startling in Anderson. Early in the war years, the Montreal group reformed itself into two opposing theoretical camps, each publishing a magazine to illustrate their dictums. Anderson, Frank Scott, A.J.M. Smith, and P.K. Page were among the leaders on the editorial board of Preview, which advanced what was called the cosmopolitan tradition in poetry. John Sutherland, a critic and editor from New Brunswick, was commanding general of First Statement, his chief henchmen being Irving Layton and Louis Dudek, joined later by Raymond Soester and Miriam Waddington. First Statement advocated, among other things, that poetry should be rooted in personal experience, remaining close to living itself. If one had to characterize the poets of these two magazines, it would be in keeping to say that the Preview people were urbane and cosmopolitan in outlook, holding to a British tradition, whereas the First Statement bunch were self-conscious rebels and roughnecks, admiring the Americans, Whitman, Masters, Frost, Hart Crane. About 1943, the rivalry and denunciations became so bitter and personal that a libel suit was threatened. But anger had cooled sufficiently by 1946 for the two magazines to merge into one, the Northern Review. During the early 1940s, Irving Layton, born 1909, began to emerge as a poet of power and authority. While still a child, Layton emigrated with his parents from Romania and settled in Montreal. His first book, Here and Now, came out in 1945, followed by several others, most of them privately printed. None attracted much attention, perhaps because Layton's poetry featured a strong flow of invective and a celebration of the flesh, somewhat strange sounding in a country late emerging from its Victorian and Puritan influences. It was not until 1955 that Layton began to attract the fame he surely deserves. In 1958, when his collected poems were published, A Red Carpet for the Sun, acclaim for the tradition-breaking Montreal schoolteacher began to pour in from all sides, and has continued to the present day. In 1965, another collected poems appeared, running to 338 pages. By this time, a few sour notes were heard among the general adulation, for Layton speaks up freely on such previously near-taboo subjects as the sexual act, using freewheeling, violent language, and he allows his own ego to obtrude vociferously in poems. He has little sense of discrimination and includes minor trivia in his collected work. Layton has been a tradition breaker, in Canada at least, in what he said, but not in techniques of prosody. Catullus is his most obvious ancestor. But those are minor strictures. By all odds, Layton is a striking and magnificent poet, and he may even agree with me in this estimate. When I first read his work myself, just before 1955, it was with surprise and delight. Layton has taken much of the previous dullness from Canadian poetry. These four poets, Layton, Burney, Klein, and Pratt, the order signifies no preference, most adequately and fairly represent Canadian poetry. Layton's Birth of Tragedy shows him at his best, and me happiest when I compose poems. Love, power, the huzzah of battle, or something, or much. Yet a poem includes them like a pool, water and reflection. In me, nature's divided things, tree, mold on tree, have their fruition. I am their core. Let them swap, bandy, like a flame swerve. I am their mouth, as a mouth I serve. And I observe how the sensual moths, big with odor and sunshine, dart into the perilous shrubbery, or drop their visiting shadows upon the garden I one year made of flowering stone to be a footstool for the perfect gods, who, friends to the ascending orders, sustain all passionate meditations and call down pardons for the insurgent blood. A quiet madman, never far from tears, I lie like a slain thing under the green air the trees inhabit, or rest upon a chair towards which the inflammable air tumbles on many robins' wings, noting how seasonably leaf and blossom uncurl, and living things arrange their death, while someone from afar off blows birthday candles for the world. The beginning of the 1950s was a period of comparative doldrums. The Ryerson Press, under the editorship of the late Lorne Pierce, had taken an early lead in publishing modern Canadian poetry during the 1940s. By 1950, this palsy had almost come to an end. John Sutherland's Northern Review was the only magazine outlet, apart from Canadian Poetry Magazine, at that time, and Sutherland shortly turned his back on the modern Canadian poetry he had previously championed. But the private publishers, Contact Press, under the leadership of Dudek and Layton, filled the book publishing gap. The Tamarack Review came along in 1956, and from that date there has been a comparative boom period for poetry in Canada. At this point, let's take a look at Canadian little magazines and critics. During the early 1940s, Alan Crawley, a blind man living in British Columbia, published Contemporary Verse. This small mimeograph magazine published the best Canadian poetry at a time when there were few other outlets. The Canadian Forum had its beginning in 1920 and continues today under the editorship of Milton Wilson, a very able critic who writes far too little criticism. The Tamarack Review appeared in 1956, with Robert Weaver becoming editor after the first few issues. Prism was born in 1959 under Jean Dubrin, succeeded by Earl Burney, with Jacob Zilber now at the helm.